Hello, my friends. Welcome back to another episode of the Principal Liner Notes podcast. This is Sean Gaylord, and I am so pleased. This has actually been, I don't know, maybe over a year, year and a half, where we've tried to kind of circle back together. And I am so pleased and grateful to have Jen Rafferty here with us as my guest, your guest. On the podcast. If you follow Jen, you already know what's coming. If you don't follow Jen, you need to follow Jen. Jen is an educator. She's a former middle school music teacher. She is my people. She is an author. She is the founder of Empowered Educator, which is a groundbreaking platform of tools and resources, and most importantly, community for teachers and educators to thrive in their profession and to grow and to connect. Jen is also a certified emotional intelligence practitioner. She is currently in the midst of some PhD work on educational psychology. But in the middle of all of that, wait, there's more. Jen is keynoting. Jen is providing professional development and speaking and providing support and consulting for educators and leaders in schools and districts all over the country. And she is also the host of a podcast, which I was very honored to be on. Take note with Jen Rafferty. Jen, maestro, welcome.
Thank you. It's so good to be here and to have this conversation with you. Anytime we get together and chat, it's always really exciting and energizing. So I can't wait to get started and dive in.
Yes, I am. I am, and I'll say this. I always feel that when I am with you, watch this seg. I always feel like I have a place in the staff, which is the name of your book. Beautiful segue. You appreciate
Love
that? That was a nice key change. I'll see you at Dakota. But Jen had wrote a book in 2019, A Place in the Staff, and this term has multiple layers of meanings. And maybe let's just start there with that journey, just the origin of having a place in the staff and what you mean by that on the kind of the different levels as a music teacher, building community in your classroom, and then really kind of how this has led down your path of empowering educators.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, first of all, I love puns. So when that popped up, I was very excited that that was going to be the title of my book. But when I wrote that, it was December of 2019. I was in a really great place in my career. I was conducting honors choirs all across New York State. I was presenting at conferences nationally a lot about cognitive development, particularly for adolescent students in relation to responsive teaching in the music classroom. I was fully living my best nerd life. And when that book came out, and when I started to really, I guess, dive into that project, it was really paying homage to my former self, who was a beginning teacher who did really great in college. I knew I was going to be a music teacher my entire life. And everyone told me I was a natural, I was so great at it. And when I got to my first classroom, particularly that seventh grade general music classroom, I was really annoyed and angry because I felt so unprepared. And I went to a great institution. I went to Ithaca College and I had incredible memories. I had fantastic professors. But at the end of the day, I knew my content, my pedagogy, and I had my three-page paper and my philosophy, but I didn't know who my kids were. And there was a huge disconnect there. So I felt not only disconnected from them and from my profession, that I thought that I wanted to do, because all of a sudden I was like, why is this so hard? I felt very disconnected from an educational community that I thought I would be really easily and seamlessly a part of, because this was very challenging for me and it seemed easy for everybody else. And what I came to realize was, everyone was actually going through the same struggles, but no one was really talking about it in a way that was productive and healthy. It was more like complaining about the overwhelm and the burnout. And this was before COVID. And so, this book was really about all of the things that I needed to know in that first few years that I did not learn in college. And, many seasoned teachers read and have read that book too, and have gleaned lots of really good nuggets from it. And I will say that the second line in that book is, as a teacher, you're a superhero. Teachers are superheroes. And what's so interesting about that is, since my TED Talk and that little clip of my TED Talk has gone viral now,
Nice.
I say teachers aren't superheroes. Like that's the line. Teachers are not superheroes. And what's so interesting about this, and this kind of segueing into your question, is at that time, finding that place in the staff, so to speak, meant that I needed to subscribe to that narrative of being a superhero so I could justify all of the stress, all of the overwhelm, all of the chaos, both at school, but also in my own life, in my marriage at the time, which I'm no longer in, because I was expected to just hold it all. I didn't need to have a day for myself because superheroes don't take a day for themselves. And throughout the time of COVID, a lot of things happened in my personal life, including the divorce, including my own healing journey. I realized that that narrative is actually the thing that's keeping people disconnected. We need to change that narrative to we're very much human because finding a place requires us to have an understanding of our connected humanity. And as much as we are in the business of people, there is a disconnect from the fibers that really make us human.
Yeah, that and you and I have talked, off camera a little bit about this and how that disconnectedness, and I, can be that catalyst for imposter syndrome, can be that catalyst for, in my case, several months ago, I had a health scare, and where when we don't find that place, when we don't find that sense of belonging, and that's the beauty of music, is that every note, every moment has a place, has an intention, gives meaning and depth to the sound, right? And regardless of whatever note or rest, it's still important. There isn't like a super note. Yeah, in guitar there's power chords, but at the end of the day, we've got five fingers that are making that power chord, right? And they all have, that you need that E string, you need that A string, whatever it may be. And so I really value that piece where it's important, because you're right there. I was guilty of that too. The whole eduhero thing, and you're an eduhero, and really putting this burden unfairly and unintentionally on folks, which again, it's a slippery slope,
It is a slippery slope, and it isn't intentional because it's unconscious.
Yeah.
It is not, it's unconscious because it's in the air that we breathe. It's in the tradition that we've been living in for decades and over a century, really. When schools first started during the Industrial Revolution, of course it made sense to focus on production and how productive can you be. That makes so much sense for that time. We don't live in that world anymore. And we have an opportunity to shift into something that's more aligned to what we need as not just individual humans, but as a culture in the bigger sense of the world, not just in the culture of your school, but everywhere. We need that humanity. And it's still, we're making progress, but needing things, having feelings, asking for help, asking, for a bathroom break is still seen as a weakness and is very often shamed.
Yeah.
And until we start changing the dialogue and having these kinds of conversations where we can start to plant seeds of, oh, well, maybe it doesn't actually have to be this way because it's always been this way. What if we were to talk a little bit differently about this? What if we were to think differently about this? What's possible if? That's a really interesting place to play. And going back to what you said with the metaphor about music, we have, when you boil it down, three very basic primal needs as human beings. It's the need for safety, the need for belonging, and it's the need for enoughness, to feel enough. That's it. And we work so hard to prove ourselves that we need to earn these things. But they are our very basic primal needs. And what if, just like how you describe being in that flow, is what you were kind of talking about, where every note is just there and all everything kind of comes together. We're in that flow state where it's safe, where there is this sense of belonging, where you are enough because there is no judgment around it. You are in flow. You know, that is the like the riptide that I want to ride on.
So making the transition from music to, because again, there's not what I love about your story and your trajectory is there's nothing traditional about it. And how, in the space of music teacher world, typically you go as far as you can within that space. So it may be chair of the department, state level, there's different associations and things of that nature. But in the space of consultant, PD, and just this path that you're on now with educational psychology, it's totally breaking the mold of a traditional music teacher path. So what compelled you to make that leap to find a different kind of flow?
Yeah, well, I always thought I would be a music teacher my entire life. You know, for me, it felt like a calling, and I really loved it. You know, and we were talking off air. I'm sure we'll circle back to this, but I built amazing programs in the places that I was at. You know, built so much community and created this space where, and when I say me, I also want to be very clear. There were 13 of us on this team, and it was 13 of us that did this. And you know, I was fortunate enough to be the department chair for a number of years, which was really great in sort of like leading the helm in all of that. But this was not a solo affair, and I want to also make that very clear. But we did really amazing things, and I could have gone on forever. And you're right, there is often a glass ceiling that we experience in education because, you know, I can't tell you the number of people, teachers, administrators, superintendents were asking me, well, when are you going to go into administration, Jen? Like, being a superintendent is really going to allow you to make the impact that you say you want to make. Why don't you go into that role? And I didn't want anything to do with that because I wanted to teach music. Music was how I was going to change the world. And I had no interest in sitting through a course about, I mean, I looked at the course descriptions, and I remember it was like going through a school budget. And I'm like looking at this course description, and I think I nodded off in the middle of that course description. And I was like, this just isn't for me. And it doesn't mean anything about me. It doesn't mean anything about my ability. This is not my path. And I knew that in my bones. And so, you know, COVID happened, and I had mentioned, you know, I had left that marriage. I had moved out of my house the same weekend the world shut down in March of 2020 with my kids, who were 5 and 7 at the time. Yeah, it was a big weekend. And you know, the plan that, you know, I was going to take my time to heal. I was going to go down to Miami and visit my sister. You know, my mother was going to come help me. But none of that helped. It happened because we were all in isolation. And so I was in isolation with my feelings and my children, and I didn't have the opportunity to suppress them or distract myself from them. I had to sit in it, and it was profoundly uncomfortable and painful. But I don't regret a single minute of it because what it allowed me to do was get it up and out in a way that I could be clean and clear to think about, well, who am I? Who do I want to be? And what is the bridge for me to get there? And so, yeah, I took off what I thought would just be a semester in fall 2020 to stay home and homeschool my kids. Went on my own healing journey, started my PhD in educational psychology, got that certification in emotional intelligence, dove even deeper into the research about mindset and cognitive neuroscience. And the more and more I learned, I started bumping out workshops for teachers because everything was virtual and people were attending and enjoying them. And I had already had an audience because of my work in presenting conferences nationally and doing my work with my music organization in New York State. And so people knew my work ethic and knew what I had to say would be valuable to their teaching. And so in February of 2021, I resigned and I wrote my letter and I was super excited. And then 4 days later, I was a hot sobby mess on my couch. Like, what did I just do? I just left my job. I am now a single mom. I have two kids to feed. And the truth was, and truth still is, I practice everything that I teach, everything. And it is the work that I teach now that got me from that moment sobbing on that couch to owning this company that is now international, to 18 months after that moment on that couch, being on that TEDx stage. And last month I was featured in Forbes. You know, like it's wild, but it's the stuff that I teach that I'm also that I also embody. And that work became very clear that I could make impact in a way that was far greater than what I could do in those four walls. Now, arts is very much a part of that, and we can talk about that later. I did not abandon my music. But it definitely took a side seat for a little while, and that's okay because it made room for other things.
When we talked a few weeks ago, we talked a little bit about, just kind of your journey. And I'm going to ask you the same question as a way to kind of highlight your company. I know that you do travel and that you do work with all levels of educators and non-educators and congratulations on the Forbes highlight there, which is that when you told me, I'm like, wait a minute, Forbes? Like the Forbes. I mean, I'm not surprised, but I mean, I'm just so happy for you. That's amazing,
Thanks.
but Forbes, who, that's awesome, but I remember asking you, what is a trend that you're seeing in all of the places that you're going in terms of empowering educators, empowering human beings? Do you see a thread? Do you see a recurrence? And I remember the first thing that you shared was, we are not okay. So I'd love for you to expand on that and share more about that.
Sure, we're not okay. There's nothing about what's going on in education that's okay from a perspective of sustainable growth and expansion for kids. And our what we say our values are very similar to the conversation we had right before we recorded. What we say our values are do not actually match our actions. And that is a disconnect that will never be corrected until we not only focus on the adults in these spaces, but also have some really confronting conversations about what our values are, what our beliefs are, questioning tradition. And I've said this a lot before, in my world, tradition is just peer pressure from dead people. That's what it is. And look, I'm not knocking tradition, but tradition unchecked is very dangerous. And that's where we are right now. I mean, you look at the progression of a car, right? When a car was first invented to what a car looks like now. You look at the progression of the telephone for what it was and what it looks like now. You look at the progression of how we send mail from the Pony Express. And was it 1866, I think is what it was, until now, where we just click a little button and then you look at schools. There is not much difference in the infrastructure. So we're changing, we're evolving, we're growing, but still very much stuck in this, well, this is how it's supposed to work. And yes, there are so many layers to this. There's community culture, there's politics, there's funding, all of it. And it is all a reflection of the disconnect. It's so disconnected. So, no, we're not okay. Yes, we all survived a pandemic. And no, we're not talking about it. We had to push through and keep going for the kids. But the kids aren't okay because we never stopped to take care of ourselves.
Right.
We never stopped. Where do you think all that stress went? Where do you think all of that anxiety went? It is still very much inside of your cells. And until we address it in ways that are safe and healthy and productive, we are not actually able to help our children the way that we say that we want to.
So how can we address it? Because as you say that, I think about my own small example where I let some things go and let my health go, and then the next thing I knew, I was in an ambulance. So how can we, with all of those kind of, in some cases, frustratingly ensconced traditions and paradigms that, you know, are just you can't, and you feel like you cannot get around or get through. So how can we?
Yeah, it feels so big, doesn't it? It feels just too enormous to even touch. But here's the truth. So often these initiatives fail, or we don't even get to a place of doing something because we're looking at that humongous mountain in front of us. And organizations don't change until people change. And the only person you have any agency in changing is you. And so, how do we make this change? Well, you need to start with yourself. And it's not just, oh, well, going to the gym is my therapy, or like, yeah, I walk on Thursdays, or like sometimes I'll once in a while take a yoga class. I'm talking about real personal growth and development of healing. And growing and changing, and understanding that change happens at the speed of safety, that your nervous system has no evidence of you living in a way that is carefree and with ease, and honoring yourself in relaxation and rest and surviving to tell the tale. Your brain's only job is to keep you alive. So that's why, it's Saturday, you're finally on a day off, and yet 3 hours into the day, if you're lucky, you're thinking about all the responsibilities that you have to do because it's your brain saying, oh, wait a second, Sean's relaxing on a Saturday morning. This isn't like him. We might die. Alert, alert, alert. Let's fill him up with all these thoughts. And so now we are back again in these emotional addictions that we continue to keep coming back to. And, I come at this work not through, I mean, I use the words social and emotional learning because that's the vernacular right now, but it's so much more than that. Like, this is really about understanding your brain, knowing the cognitive neuroscience of what makes you, and giving you the tools to navigate it because you have so much more power than you realize. And we are constantly waiting for somebody else to save us. Constantly. If someone would just take something off our plate, if this person would just get their act together, then my life would finally be great. If my kids would just pick up after themselves, well, then I could stop being a nudge. Like, this is not how it works. And if we continue to place our self-worth and our emotional well-being in the hands of everything and everyone that's external, you are never going to feel good, and we are never going to make any sort of change. So I come in, and my team comes in, and we show you how, in the most beautiful, compassionate, loving way that you could possibly experience within community of other educators who are doing the same, so that they can not only show up differently for themselves and their families and their students and their colleagues, but so their students can see that adults live their life differently. And we are changing the paradigm of what's possible because we're in the business of making generational change. And so that's really what we do here.
So I think about when I do this podcast, I always think about the solitary person, the lonely person. I this is this whole podcast is very intentional to connect with that principal or aspiring principal or teacher or educator who they just no one's saving a seat for them. At the faculty meeting, no one is providing a place for them, literally and metaphorically, in the staff. So I'm always thinking about that person. I was that person, as a leader and as an educator. So for those who want to feel that, what you just said from your team, where are those entry points for procuring that experience through Empowered Educator? What are those things that you do offer and those experiences to provide that sense of belonging and healing and community, and ultimately the end result, or the way I interpret it is and your word in your bio is for the person to thrive, and to continue to thrive.
Yeah, so we go about this in so many different ways because access is really important to us. So particularly for school leaders, time feels very scarce. And sitting down for a course is not something that feels super accessible. In fact, it probably will feel really stressful as like you have to do this other thing and then you beat yourself up and feel guilty about it when you miss it because you have this other fire come up. And so I'm not available to create a program or a company that invokes more stress. That this is me walking the talk is really what we do. So we've created multiple entry points for people, including self-paced classes. Yeah, sure, there are live virtual things. Everything we do is on a replay. Everything we do is on a private podcast. So if you want to listen to it while you're in the car or on a walk, you can do that too. We've created a program where we offer one-to-one coaching for leaders and educators too, in a different capacity, but particularly for school leaders. But also, we can provide a group coaching scenario. But to me, that's another thing that people would have to show up for. So there's an option for that. But there's also a really simple question and answer page. So if you want to shoot me a really quick question, I make a 2 or 3 or 5 minute video about this thing and I pop it up, and then you get to find it right there and you can watch whenever you want.
Nice.
And everyone else benefits from your question. And so we have this beautiful element of creating safety and visibility too, because part of that being alone, feeling, which is just a feeling. It's not the truth. It is a feeling. There comes with it often this idea of what I have to say isn't valued. My voice doesn't matter. That's sometimes where imposter syndrome comes in. And so when we create these safe spaces for people to be visible, they remember their power, they remember their voice, they practice using their voice. And that practice becomes the new belief that no longer are you really believing that my voice doesn't matter. Here, you just gave your brain all of this evidence that not only does your voice matter, it's really important, and people actually learn from you when you use it. So that's just kind of the skinny version of some examples of how this works. We are constantly creating new ways to reach people where they are.
I love that. I love the your phrase creating safe spaces so people feel visible. And that's so that's the gig. It really is. And that kind of echoes too, and I think one perfect example of this is your garage rock renaissance story, in which you and a team of folks created some safe spaces for kids to not only feel visible but to be feel heard, and through their musical expression. I love this story, and I'd love for you to share it.
Sure, I love this story too. like I said, when I was a beginning teacher, I was really annoyed about how much I felt so unprepared. And in learning more about my kids, particularly adolescents and their cognitive development, I started making program that was responsive to where they were. And so it included a lot of hands-on things. And there was a stack of guitars in the back where the person before me never used them. They were dusty. There was 10 of them. And of course, I had a class of like 28 kids. And they were like, "Mr. Haverty, can we play a guitar? Can we play guitar?" And I shared with you too, I went to music school. I was a vocal performance and music education major. I never played guitar. I was a soprano. I was a little bit of a diva at that. And the center stage in the spotlight was always my place on stage. It never occurred to me that I would even have an opportunity, let alone a desire to maybe do something else. And so I learned how to play guitar. I was like a couple days ahead of the kids, and I taught them guitar, and there were 10 of them. So I had to quickly find four other guitars because I had a class of 28, and we would sit in pairs with one music stand, and they would alternate. And the person not playing guitar had to like check their fingers and check their posture, whatever. It was all stuff. So, little by little, through grants writing, through endlessly looking at garage sales and other secondhand stores, I found enough guitars that we could have a class set. And then those seventh grade kids didn't have any other place to go after that. And during that year, there was a hallway right outside my classroom that led down to the stairs in the cafeteria. And there was this kid who would frequently sit there and play guitar. And he was in high school. We had a 712 building. So I went up to him one day and I was like, "Hey, who are you? You're amazing." And it's like, "Oh, I'm Jimmy. My dad's a musician and I play guitar. And I really like this hallway, this space, because this one has the best acoustics in the school."
Wow.
So, which told me a lot too, that he's tried the other ones. And this one is very particular. And I also think there was a little bit of fate that happened in that pairing as well, because Jimmy was really the person who inspired me to ask a series of questions like, "Why aren't you in the music program?" And there wasn't a place for him. I was in band, but I really didn't like it. I kind of played bass, I kind of played drums, but it wasn't really my thing. And there's really no place else I could play music for the school, so I don't. And that broke my heart. As a baby teacher, music was for everyone. I said it on my 3-page philosophy paper. Music is for everyone. Why isn't that the case here? And when I looked at the numbers and the data, 15% of the high school students were involved in music classes. So where was this other 85%? And this number, it's greater on a national level. It's closer to like 20 or 30%, but this is still very true. And there are movements now making sure that more people are being seen and heard in these music programs at schools. But it wasn't like that when, 15 years ago. It just wasn't. So this guitar class, Jimmy would come in and teach it sometimes, and he would come in and play for the kids, so they have like representation and like see this really cool junior, playing guitar. These little seventh graders like, "Oh my gosh, I could do that," And
Nice.
so there was this moment of just not just really good community happening, but like this good education happening, getting these kids to see beyond what was in front of them. And those kids wanted more music classes. So we advocated for a guitar class in high school, and that guitar class turned into a modern band class where kids would learn how to play keys and drums and bass and have some vocals. Often they would ask me to be their lead singer of their band, which I obviously always said definitely yes. I was very excited to be in their bands. But sometimes I would, play bass. Sometimes I would play keys. I challenged myself to learn bass. I put myself in the jazz band actually because they needed a bass player, and I was like, "I'll do it." So I learned jazz bass for a while. And actually, funny story, yeah, my first concert as a jazz, in the, with the jazz band, I'm standing in the back of the stage, and I'm like, I don't know where to look. I'm like, what do I do with my face? Like, I'm used to being the singer in the front, but it was such a moment right there. It was so funny to me.
What do I do?
What do I do? But what was also so great was the kids were able to see that I was also on this journey with them. Like, oh, guitar is hard for you? Yeah, it's really hard for me too. Like, I have a really hard time doing bar chords too. Let's learn this together. And so I was very closely involved in that learning process alongside of them. And so, yeah, now, I mean, years have gone by and it is a very robust program where kids are actively like writing, performing, and producing their own tunes. And it's been phenomenal and really has brought garage band culture back. I was telling you earlier, Portland is the home base of, Ronnie James Dio. He went to Portland High School and we have this beautiful rich history of music here in this little town. And it kind of went away for a little while. That we had got like some heavy rockers who are now in like their 60s and early 70s who are still around, who talk about the good old days, who really appreciate this new wave of kids performing. And I have students come back and like, Miss Rafferty, I'm out playing with my band and they're in their mid-20s now. And they said, you are the first person who put the guitar in my hand. And oof, it that just that gets me every time. And so, yeah, seeing something bigger than what's in front of you was, I think, the big takeaway from that whole experience.
I love every bit of that story, and I've got this visual of you playing jazz bass, like what?
I'll send you the picture. I was like I had
That's that. And again, for those of you, the jet, the bassist, that's the bottom, and they're behind the scenes, and they're yeah.
Yeah, and usually super cool, which is something like I just don't identify with.
Yeah. Speaking of music, what, and I may have asked you this before, when we first met, or and I've forgive me if I've forgotten, but what was it that you heard that you knew this is what I want to do for the rest of my life? Was it, I mean, was it something you saw on TV, something that you heard, is it just genetic? What was that piece or that moment that just went, okay, yeah, music is going to be a part of my life, my active life for eternity. This is it.
Well, the story goes, I was barely walking and I would line up my stuffed animals in the living room and perform for them, so this was something that was always a part of who I was and wanted to do. The stage was always very comfortable for me and very exciting. And as I went through school, I was really fortunate to have outstanding music teachers. And I was a part of a theater company when I was a kid too, so I was always performing and learning a lot about myself through music, through theater, through character development. And when I got to high school, my teacher at that point was Eric Williams, and I mentioned him in the book too. He really made it his goal to make sure that each of us found the music that already existed inside of us, that it wasn't something that we had to get externally. It was already there. So we had, I'm getting chills even just like saying this, we just had to find it. And then once we did, we had a responsibility to share it. And it's in the sharing of it that really continues to drive me in what I even do now, because your voice is one of the most powerful things that you have. And on my own personal growth journey, what's been so interesting is, I'm a claimed trained classical singer. I've performed for, more times than I could possibly try to count. But finding my voice in other arenas of my life has been challenging. And I keep coming back to the irony of that. And taking pieces of the things that I've learned through my training, through my experiences of sharing my voice into, my life now, and then teaching the work that I do now. And I want to share a story because this is coming up as relevant right now. I stopped singing for a long time because after I was teaching music and I moved into this career that I now have, I would sing every day. Not just with my kids, like I'd be on a prep period and I'd be like, hey, Ben, who was my awesome coworker and friend for many years, can we just sing? And we would just sit down at the piano and we would sing together and we'd feel great. And then we'd go off and we'd do our prep work or whatever we needed to do. But I didn't have that anymore. And I just stopped. And there was this voice in my head, Jen, sing, 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 sing. And I finally answered the call. And I called up my old one of my former professors who lives close by, and I said, "Hey, Carol, can we have a lesson?" I hadn't had a voice lesson since college, and so she said, "Absolutely, come on." So I said, "Okay, I think there's a lot of stuff gonna come up when I'm playing." She's like, "It's okay, just go piano, go play something." So okay, so I sit down at the piano, and she does what I used to do with my students. She would hold up emotion cards. So I'd be singing, she'd hold up an emotion, and I would fully embody that emotion while I'm singing. And then we'd stop and then we'd talk about it afterwards. So, it was like, okay, so confused. What did that feel like? Where did you feel that in your body? Oh, interesting. Confused happened in my forehead. Oh, contentment happened, like my chest was really expansive. Oh, worried, that was in my stomach. These kinds of things is really important when you're embodying art like this, because art and emotion, of course, are deeply connected. Well, then I started singing a song that was really mirrored the place that I was at in my life. And she puts an emotion that also matches that thing. And Sean, I lost it. I mean, blubbering like a baby, head in my hands, uncontrollable crying. And she was great. She just let me. She didn't say anything. She just let me. And when I was done, she says, "Keep going." So I did. And I was, kind of making it through. And she's like, "Nope, keep going, Jen." So I kept going. And all of this stuff that was inside came out. And what I realized and what we talked about afterwards is that we have such a cognitive understanding of emotion, and it stops there. But emotional embodiment, particularly through the arts, is something that can only be experienced. And as a performer, you have to go there in order to hold the emotion for your audience. And bringing that back to what I do now, that's what we teach now too, is this: at you as the leader of your school have to go there so you can hold it for everybody else. That is one of your roles. And does it feel uncomfortable? Yeah. Is your brain like, "Nope, no, thank you. We don't do that. We don't do emotions." Like, is that something that might be coming up for you right now listening to this? Absolutely. Because again, going back to what I said before, your brain doesn't have any evidence of you doing this and surviving. I promise you're not going to cry forever. But I do promise you that in that release of emotion, you were going to get out on the other side feeling so much cleaner and having, and well, I'm going to rephrase that, realizing your capacity to hold it for others.
It's one, thank you for sharing that. It's beautiful and moving. And as you share that, I think about conducting. I'm thinking about Bernstein right now and how, if you've seen the movie with Bradley Cooper, or if you've you can go on YouTube and you can just find it. But I think part of what made him great at what he did is he did the very thing that you just said. Like he invested himself in the music, and he embodied it, and he went there, for the orchestra so that they could go there and get there, and Bernstein's not the only guy that did this. There are dozens of great conductors that either emulated what he did or are striving for that same moment. And that's so important as a leader, regardless of what title you have, and is important. It's cathartic. And it's communal, and it's universal, and it brings people together. When any set of music, I mean, Bernstein is, he's, there's kind of the, what's the word? The kind of the typical Bernstein where he's hair's moving and he's crying and he's grimacing and he's into it, and he's got that just great, I don't have hair, but he just does that great head bob, you know what I'm talking about, and his wavy hair goes back. But then there's also joy, and he's into it. So like if he's playing like some ebullient Mozart riff, he's dancing a little bit, and he's got a little groove, and you feel that, and I think it's important. And but yet, Jen, there is courage in that vulnerability. It takes a lot of strength to kind of put yourself out there, because he could easily, hey, y'all paid your money, I'm getting a check. Dun, 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 all right, okay, see you at the Coda, let's go, there's a lot of courage in that as a leader, to invest that, right?
Yeah, so there's a couple. I'm just writing this down so I don't want to lose it. So there's courage and vulnerability right now because of unsafe it feels. Because that is, like I said before, that's our one of our primal needs is safety. And because we live in the world where vulnerability still equals weakness, it requires courage. But when we look at the communities that we have fostered within Empowered Educator, I would not describe people showing up as courageous at all. I would describe it as honoring themselves,
Yes.
because we've
Also, thank you.
already created the safe space. And I want to be clear about this too, because we throw around that word safe space all the time by like slapping on a sticker on our wall and say, "Hey, door open policy is a safe space." But you really need to ask yourself, what evidence do you have that actually creates this safe space that you speak of? And we've got the receipts. So this space that we have created is sacred in the fact that there are rules. And if you don't abide by the rules, you need to leave. Like that is a boundary here.
Right on.
So that's important, and that courage piece, because you're right. And
Gotcha.
it
Gotcha.
means
Totally get that. Thank you.
yeah, and so here's the other thing too, because and this is something that I am now embedding into the leadership programs that we have, is that your capacity to lead is dependent on your own personal growth and development. Your capacity for impact is dependent on your own personal growth and impact. Because if you yourself are uncomfortable with vulnerability, and somebody comes into your office and is trying to use their voice and express something that feels vulnerable, you will not be able to resonate with them. In fact, you will probably squash it and squander any sort of open door policy or trust that you are trying to build. We do this with our children too, right? We stop crying. Why? Because it's making me feel really uncomfortable, right? And when you go deeper and deeper and deeper, you are able to realize, again, I'm going to use that word capacity, realize your capacity, because you already have it. It's just like gunked up with all this stuff. And I'm not going to go into what that stuff is right now,
I hear you.
I can at another time. But it's just gunked up with all this stuff, most of which isn't your fault, the majority of which is not your fault, that we just can't. And so when you dive in and you get clean and clear and you're able to find your own safety in your own vulnerability, other people resonate with that and can show up for that within themselves too. So many times leadership workshops or when I'm working with someone one-to-one, they're like, how do I create a team where everyone feels safe and supported? And, they're looking for a checklist. They're looking for, well, if you just do this, 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 and this, then you're good. But the truth is, you need to put a mirror up to yourself and do this work for you. That is the only way you are going to create sustainable change that you're telling me that you want right now. And yes, it does take courage right now, but I got you. And my team's got you, and everyone else in this space got you too.
Nice. It kind of echoes our Miles Davis quote, there's no such thing as mistakes. And the very famous story of Herbie Hancock, playing, he hit a wrong note, he hit a mistake, and he thought he was done. He thought it was over. No, Miles played the mistake, and somehow musically, yeah, this is what we intended to do all along. And several things. One, from a musical standpoint, the show's got to go on. You got to get to the end, so you got to keep going. Folks have paid to see you. But then two, building that community. What a powerful message where it's okay. And I hear and I see you, and you know what? I'm with you. So I'm gonna play your mistake, like it was intended all along, like it made sense. And if it doesn't make sense, or if it doesn't sound like it, that's still the hell okay, because we're together. We're in the band together. We all have a place in the staff,
Yeah. Isn't
right?
that cool? Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Before we wrap up, Jen, I gotta ask you this. I think I've asked you this before, and you've asked this to me. Not only what's on your turntable, but let's go beyond that. All right. Desert island, you're getting ready to jump out the plane, you got the parachute, you're gonna be on this desert island, your whole record collection's on that plane. I don't want to get into streaming or all that stuff, but what are those, because obviously streaming, if you got good Wi-Fi, whatever, but what are those essential records that you're going to bring with you? What are those pieces of music that you're going to bring with you on that desert island? Go.
Okay, so there are three things that are coming to mind. First, and that's actually what's on my turntable now, so to speak, is one of the things that's on a rotation, is Pink's Trust Fall album.
Nice.
Love it. Obsessed. Obsessed. I can't listen to it without crying. I just
It. I love
I
it.
yeah, it's it is it speaks to my soul. Second is the musical soundtrack to Ragtime.
Oh,
That
wow.
is something I can listen to over and over and over and over and over again. Also, can't listen to it without crying. And then the third thing would actually be one of my favorite singers, who's Jane Monheit. She's a jazz singer. You know her,
Yes, yes, I
amazing.
do.
I've gone to several of her concerts, and during COVID, she was actually giving voice lessons. And so I was able to have two voice lessons with her, which was just phenomenal. And I love her voice. I love the way she plays with melodies. I love her song choices. Like the American Songbook is really where my heart is. And that's the stuff that I enjoy singing the most too. So she speaks to my heart.
Wow, yeah, she does. I forget the name of her live album, but she's playing either, I don't know, it's the Rainbow Room or Cafe Carlisle or someplace, and she does one of the, and in fact she says as they lead in, and I always think it's such a cool move for a vocalist, when the music starts vamping and then she starts talking, she doesn't sing yet, and she go and so they start doing the opening to Waters of March, the great.
I knew you were going to say that
You knew I
because
was going there.
I did. Yes, because
Yes.
that song, the way she does it, just oh my gosh.
Love
I
that
was just in
freaking
New
song.
Orleans 2 weeks ago, and I was at this bar called Fritzl's. If you're ever in New Orleans, go to Fritzl's. It's this just little teeny tiny hole in the wall, and they just have music there all the time. And there was this guy playing keys, and no music. It was like, what do you want to hear? What do you want to hear? And Waters of March. I was like, Waters of March. I want to hear Waters of March.
Love that song. It
Yes.
it's for those of you who aren't familiar, Waters of March is an old bossa nova Brazilian standard from the pen of Antonio Carlos Jobim. And what a stick, a stone, the end of the road. Come on.
And her voice, like
Yes.
that, it's just butter.
Yes. And she just and it's and it and it, it it's a hard song to sing. I mean,
Yes.
it's a
I
hard
don't
song to play.
even sing that song because I feel like I can do a lot of things great, but that one I set aside. That is something that I want to listen to that. I don't feel like I can honor that song in the way that
Yeah.
she.
Cause she has like crazy breath control. I don't know. Is there a third lung going on? I don't know, but because you can't, it's a great song, but it's quick. It's like Burt Bacharach. You gotta know those breaths, baby. And then that note at the end, that goes on and on. It's like, whoa. But that's a oh yeah, okay. So all right, that's a pretty good soundtrack for that desert island, Jen.
That'll sustain me for quite some time.
Yeah, and then on that desert island, you can practice your breathing to hit Waters of March, right? Oh.
By the time I'm done, I'll be able to sing that song. I'll come back and I'll sing
Yeah,
it.
that is.
And play
Oh,
it at
I'll
the
put a link to that song in the show notes for folks, because she's just delightful, fun, ebullient, life affirming, and yeah, just. You're right. Her voice is just, it's just butter, it's just.
Butter. Just butter. Yeah, last time I saw her live, she ended with very similarly, she band's playing, she's
I
talking.
love that move.
I yeah, I didn't it, and it, he was vamping, the piano player was vamping, so I didn't even know what song it was going to be. And she ended with Pure Imagination.
Oh, wow.
I don't even think that it's on any album. I think that was just one of those like live moment situations. But man alive. Woo!
Well, either she's got to get on your podcast. We gotta work that out. Jane, if you're listening, find Jen, biggest fan, hey, I'll run sound, whatever. That God, yeah.
It's good stuff.
It is. So if as folks are checking out Waters of March, how can they check you out and track you down?
Oh, great question. So empowerededucator.com is the website. And if you go to the resources page, there's a bunch of free resources on there for you and or your staff. And I would love to actually hear from you and your experiences with your wellness and your well-being and your vision for what you want education to be. And I enjoy nothing more than having this very important conversation with people who are ready to have it. So email is hello@empowerededucator.com. You can find me on Instagram at Jen Rafferty underscore or on Facebook at Empowered Educator Faculty Room.
Jen really means that too, friends. It is a very much an inclusive and inviting community. All are welcome. I love when Jen will put and she and her content is on the regular. So if you do subscribe and or follow her on Facebook, there's always an invitation. She will share. She invites. It's she's the real deal, and you will definitely. All have a place in the staff, so I'm excited. And then real quick, Jen, I would be remiss if we did not mention the Forbes thing. So if you could, because this is I want you to brag on this a little bit, because this is such a huge deal. I'd love for you to share that.
Sure. So, with this whole superhero narrative and my journey with this transformation of really buying into that and now on this other side and having these conversations about it, that really resonated or hit a chord, if you will, with a lot of people. And there was this incredible woman who writes for Forbes, and we were connected, and so she really highlighted that narrative. You know, her vantage point is about women. And then in the second half of the article, focuses about me and my story and Empowered Educator and what we're doing here in relation to that narrative. And it was just really exciting. You know, Forbes was a pie in the sky dream, just like the TED Talk. You know, it's this pie in the sky. And I'm being completely transparent when I say the reasons why these things keep coming into my lived reality is because I am working the work that I teach. I am consistently coming back to myself and regulating my nervous system, creating safety in my ability to grow beyond my comfort zone, because TEDx was really scary. You know, even thinking about being in Forbes felt scary until it wasn't. And the only reason why it wasn't anymore was because I did the work on myself. And now it's like, okay, now what? How good can this get? What else can we do so our impact with Empowered Educator can reach everybody who wants it? And I get to consistently commit to that so I can continue to grow and be an expander for everyone else who comes into my world and show them what's possible.
Nice. I just love the symphony that you are living and that you are composing and inviting others to play in every day. It's a beautiful, evolving work. It is what our world needs. It's what our profession and education needs right now. So Jen Rafferty, you are amazing, and I'm just so grateful for your time and your expertise and this conversation. Seriously.
Yeah, thank you. Right back at you. It's been such a pleasure to know you. I'm so glad that we connected when we did, and we get to continue to have these very inspiring conversations. And I can't wait to do it again. So thank you for your time. Thank you.
Oh, right on, my friend. We're in the band together. And
Oh yeah.
speaking of being in the band together, to all of our listeners and viewers out there, here is the sign off for you. Don't forget to share with the world your dreams, your visions, your ideas, your symphonies, because the world needs you, and you help make the world a better place. This is Sean Gaylord with my guest, Jen Rafferty. Thank you for stopping by the Principal Liner Notes. Hope to catch you on the flip side or at a Jamon Hyde gig someplace singing Waters of March. Thanks again.